Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians in social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you so much for coming Saturday afternoon after lunch, and you're here. You are diehards. You're very committed. I appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to be here. Hopefully we're all in the right place. This is a session on looking at child trauma, spirituality, and expressive arts. Come on in, everybody. Come on. My goal for this session, we only have an hour today, is to talk about what I mean by child trauma, expressive arts, and spirituality. Also, I'm going to give you a little bit of background on how I got to using expressive arts with kids who have been traumatized, and then a little bit about the correlation or connection between those three different variables. And then I want to give you a little information about a couple programs that I've been intimately involved with over the last 7 years, where we're working with traumatized kids and using expressive arts to help them heal. So the underlying question that I want to look at today is how do expressive arts assist in spiritual development and healing from child trauma? So let me lay something right out on the table for you. Number one, I am not an art therapist. Okay? I'm not an art therapist. The reason why I say that is because I've worked with a lot of art therapists, and they have master's degrees, specialized training, and certifications. And so I want to just lay that out, that I am a doctoral level, licensed clinical social worker who just so happens to use expressive arts in a therapeutic way with kids who are healing from trauma. So how did I get into using expressive arts? Well, I came by sheer desperation. Well, back in the 1980s, my first job out of school was as a youth and family service counselor, and I realized pretty quickly with working with adolescents that the traditional sit in your office with a box of tissues and tell me how you feel approach didn't work really well with kids and adolescents. And so I started looking back at my own adolescence and said, what were the things that helped me through a difficult time? And it was things like music. It was things like journaling. It was things like outdoor adventure activities. It was sports and those types of things. So I said, how can I incorporate those into the work I was doing with teens at the time? Unfortunately, it wasn't very popular back then to use those types of activities with teens back in the 80s. There wasn't a whole lot of literature out yet or research on the value of using those activities with kids or adolescents. But I knew, just kind of a gut-level feeling, that it was incredibly impactful. I could get more out of a teenage kid playing basketball with them for an hour and talking about their day than I could sitting in a sterile office talking about how's your feelings going. And so I started incorporating those type of activities into my approach at the Youth and Family Service Association. It was fairly successful, enough where the high schools in the area and stuff, I started getting some write-ups in the paper. And so a big behavioral healthcare company asked me if I would come aboard, if they could hire me to come with them to help them with their adolescent programming. They ran short and long-term residential programs for kids and adolescents, and many of them were leaving early. They were leaving against medical advice. They weren't having a very good time engaging them into the treatment process. So they said, can you use any of that crazy stuff you do, Phelps, to get them more involved with the treatment program? So I spent the next 12 years working for that behavioral health care company, and they had 33 programs in 4 states. And I hired art therapists and music therapists and drama therapists and exercise physiologists and adventure therapists. And we distributed them amongst all the programs and started incorporating ways to engage children and adolescents in the healing process. So I've had some experience developing and building expressive arts programs. I also have had some experience of working with some of the best art therapists, music therapists, drama, and movement therapists out there. So I've learned a lot from them over the course of the last 25 years. Most of my work since 1985 has been with adolescents and their families. In 2005, I was asked to help out with the Red Cross Mental Health Disaster Team after Katrina. And I was stationed in San Antonio at Pelley Air Force Base, and they had a couple huge hangars full of people who had come from New Orleans. And one of my jobs was to work with the kids. And during that time, I kind of tied in my stuff that I've been doing with adolescents, and I said, how can I use expressive arts with some of the kids here in the shelter? And so we started using expressive arts and experiential therapies with some of the kids there. And then I felt this calling, and I fought. And God was saying, you need to do this with little ones. And I was like, no, God, no. I work with teenagers. I've been doing it my whole professional life, 20-some years. I'm good at it. I like to stay at that. And God said, no, I want you to work with the little ones. I want you to, and I was so like, one thing I've learned from being this old and having this gray hair is that fighting God like that has never worked for me. Never worked for me, and it's always been persistent when he tells me and calls me for those things. And so I started doing programs for young kids, and then, as I'll share later in the presentation today, started working with little ones in a homeless shelter, and then during a university sabbatical last year, I worked with little ones at an orphanage in Mexico doing expressive arts programs. Throughout this presentation, you're going to see some pictures. I want to reassure you that all the pictures that I'm using have been used in the agency's promotional PR stuff on their website and the brochures. All the parents and kids have given their permission, and I'm certainly not breaking any of their trust or confidentiality. I want to start this presentation, though, with some of my core beliefs about this. So let me just read these for you. Expressive arts are inherently spiritual and can be a natural form of spiritual expression. Second is expressive arts are naturally therapeutic and have a potential to help us feel more whole. There is a long and intimate history of relationship between art and spirituality, art and healing, and spirituality and healing. The use of expressive arts can be a powerful therapeutic intervention for children who have experienced trauma. The use of expressive arts can help move children from not only being survivors, but thrivers, through skill building, support networks, and resiliency enhancement. And then the last one I think is a core assumption that I have is that children have spiritual lives. I truly believe that with all my heart. So what I want to do is I want to talk about some quick definitions of these terms. For expressive arts, my definition is similar to the International Expressive Arts Therapy Association. But when I talk about expressive arts today, what I'm talking about is activities such as dance, poetry, music, drama, drawing, creative writing, sculpture, photography, all of those different types of activities. So it's a pretty broad definition. Remember that using expressive arts is not the same thing as expressive arts therapy. Two different things. The therapeutic use of expressive arts by non-credentialed counselors and social workers is different in that it simply focuses on the inherent therapeutic value of children participating in creative endeavors. And so while both encourage creative expression, the context, facilitation, and purpose is very different. When you're using expressive arts as a method in your healing, you're not necessarily, if you're not an art therapist, music therapist, using it for assessment or a specific clinical approach. You're using it more for its inherent value. All right? When I talk about spirituality today, I'm talking about a person's core purpose and meaning in their lives. The best metaphor I can use always is the flower in the pot. To me, the flower is spirituality, and the pot is, however, what supports you in your environment. That may be a faith tradition, but for some people it may be science, for some people it may be humanism. But the spirituality part is the flower, and that can either grow or not grow, and that can be supported by the pot. So somebody's spiritual development, child's spiritual development, can be nurtured by the faith tradition or religion that they're a part of, or it can be inhibited by that, right? So if you grew up in a toxic environment, if you grew up in a church that where it's been very punitive, then that soil in that pot is not very nurturing. It can impede the spiritual development of the child. So that's, to me, the difference of spirituality and religion. Religion means that you do it over and over and over again. You can be a religious dope smoker, right? Religion just means that you do it over practices, rituals, that sort of thing. Right? To me, those are very different things. When I talk about child trauma today, what I want to talk about is this in generalities as well. I'm talking about things such as child sexual abuse and physical abuse, family violence, things like neglect, natural disasters, that sort of thing. So it's a pretty broad definition of child trauma. And we know that kids respond to child trauma in different ways. Some respond through PTSD. Some respond through anxiety, through depression, through other behavioral problems. And so kids may respond, they may be, they're pretty resilient, and sometimes they come back pretty quickly, but other ones struggle for longer periods of time depending on how severe the trauma was. To me, using expressive arts for spiritual development and for healing trauma is natural for social workers. Why? Because we believe in a strengths perspective. We also believe in a holistic approach, an integrated approach. When we do an assessment, right, we use a bio, psycho, social, spiritual, cultural, all of those things, we look at the whole person. And so to me, using expressive arts and spiritual development and healing trauma is a pretty natural transition for a lot of us. The other thing is we know that using art for spiritual development and healing is as old as the paintings on the cave wall. We've been using it for thousands of years. Indigenous cultures know it better than we do. When I travel to Africa, when I travel to Mexico and other countries, they're all about arts as a way of communicating. And in our country, it's only been in the last two or three decades that I really feel like people are starting to get it. And part of that is due to advances in technology. Because the more we are able to look at brain scans and neuroscience, we're able to see the impact of expressive arts and how they help people heal from trauma. When we talk about spirit, mind, body, I love this quote from Alice Miller. I don't know how many of you have read her work. But it says, the truth about our childhood is stored up in our body, and though we can repress it, we can never alter it. Our intellect can be deceived, our feelings manipulated, our perceptions confused, and our bodies tricked with medication. But someday, the body will present its bill, for it is as incorruptible as a child who still whole in spirit will accept no compromise or excuses, and it will not stop tormenting us until we stop evading the truth. How true, huh? How true. So, one of the reasons I first started using expressive arts with kids is because I realized how difficult it was for them to put into words what was going on inside of them. Most of us grew up in homes where we had good teachers who taught us. They said things like, when we look really angry at our brothers and sisters, they go, wow, you look really angry. Or, you know, they use those words and they help us label this internal process. A lot of the kids we work with have not had that luxury, have not had people who help them put external symbols to internal things that are going on, feelings, thoughts, emotions, that sort of thing. And so one of the things that we try to do with expressive arts is we try to use them in a way to help kids put external symbols to that internal process. We know that kids who grow up in toxic home environments learn three important survival skills. Don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. And then they come to us, and what is the first thing we ask them to do? Talk, trust, and feel, right? And then we get surprised, like, why they don't do that. It's because if they have learned those, it's a survival skill. And so what we have to do then is try to figure out what are some backdoor ways in which we can get to what's going on for them without them feeling threatened, without them having to lift up their defenses so quickly, without having to feel like they need to protect themselves. Right? So what we're trying to do is create a language. And I love this quote here. It says, expressive arts offer children a way to express their feelings, perceptions, thoughts, and memories in words, in ways that words simply cannot. So another thing that I try to do when I do expressive arts with kids is I always try to do it in groups. Why? Because I believe that in groups we can build community. When kids are working together on projects, then they learn how to create a language together. They realize that other people are struggling with the same things that they are, and they feel mutual support. When they create a piece of art, whether that's music or painting or something like that, and they hold it up for their group members, and they go, wow, that's amazing. Or the leader or authority figure says, nice job. They're encouraged to keep trying to find external symbols for what's going on inside of them. And so I really believe that working in a group helps our kids develop hope, helps them support one another, and helps them learn from one another. I also believe that expressive arts changes a child's physiology. One of my heroes is a guy named Bruce Perry. Some of you know him, he's been on Oprah, but he's a psychiatrist who works at the Child Trauma Center in Houston, Texas. And he's one of the few psychiatrists I know that can talk about neuroscience in a way in which I go, I get it, right? Because most neuroscience is right over our heads. And so what Bruce Perry and other psychiatrists have found out is that when kids experience trauma, any kind of stress, it triggers the fight or flight response, right? So we know that it hits the amygdala and it jacks up the body, so we're either able to fight, we're able to flee, so our blood pressure goes up. We know our heart rate and our breathing rate and stuff go up too. And so with that, then that's what's called the sympathetic nervous system. After the threat is gone, then your parasympathetic nervous system kicks in. And if the threat's gone, it helps bring things back to homeostasis and balance again. So if right now we heard a loud noise outside that sounded like a shot, our amygdala would kick in, all those systems would get raised, our heart rate goes up, all those things happen. And within a couple minutes, if we realize that somebody just dropped something out there, the parasympathetic nervous system kicks in, and we get calmer. Now, guess what happens when you do expressive arts and they study the brain? Parasympathetic nervous system kicks in. So it literally helps kids reduce the amount of stress that they're experiencing. Now, it's important when you work with kids who've been traumatized to understand this and the way the stress response works, because kids who experience trauma over an extended period of time have what's called a hyperarousal, or a stress response that's on all the time. And this eventually causes a lot of physical and psychological damage. But they look like kids who are hyperactive. They look like kids sometimes who are struggling in school focusing and stuff like that. And what they're having is a physiological response to the chronic stress that they're experiencing. Now, the body does an amazing thing. Once there's so much stress that we can't fight or flight, what does it do? Freeze, right? It freezes. Dissociative state. Or what happens is the body, instead of jacking everything up and secreting things that look like speed, it slows everything down. And your brain actually produces biochemicals that are like opiates, painkillers. And you'll find kids actually in fetal positions trying to protect vital organs. And so that's what happens if we can't fight or flight from the threat. So when we're working with kids who are struggling with trauma, we have to be careful, because an activity that we do can in many ways trigger that stress response that's already been at a hyperarousal rate and cause them more harm than good. So one of the things I found to be incredibly helpful, how many of you have ever seen those heart rate monitors that you use for exercising? Obviously, I could use one more. But those heart rate monitors that you use for exercising, they measure your heartbeat. If you put one of those on a kid at the beginning of group, and after a second, they don't even realize they have it on anymore, but it's got big lettering on there, so when they're running, you can see it, you can get the normal kid heart rate, and you can find out very quickly whether or not an activity is starting to increase their stress. Okay? For somebody like me, I'm a big dude, and so I come in just to a room with little kids, and I can see some of those monitors go up. Just because I'm a male, and a lot of their perpetrators were male, and the size that I am. And so then I have to work carefully with them to make sure that I can try to get that rate down again. And so we have to be careful when working with kids, because we can actually re-traumatize them in many ways. Another thing that's important is to understand the way the brain develops. Our brain develops, and I don't want to try to oversimplify this, but the brain develops from the bottom up and the inside out. This is the brain stem. This is where all that really natural stuff we never have to think about happens. Like, we don't have to say, how many times will a heart beat? Should I breathe now? We don't have to think about that, because it's all done for us. That's brainstem stuff. That's one of the first things to develop. And the inside is the limbic system. That's where your amygdala is at, hypothalamus. That's the emotional aspect of the brain. And the outside is the cortex, right? The cortex is the part where we cognitive thought. And then that top part is the prefrontal cortex, which is like our executive director of our brain. Right? And so thankfully, in a mature brain, we have all those components, because that middle part is called the low road, and this is called the high road. And so if I'm out in the hallway and somebody makes me mad and I say, I'm going to punch that person, that's the emotional brain kicking in. Hopefully, the cortex kicks in and the prefrontal cortex says, whoa, slow down, let's think about that for a minute. Let's think about all the consequences that could happen if you hit somebody, and we pause and then we don't do it. Now, the reason why this is important is because latest research has shown that when kids are traumatized, The brain, the neural pathways at that point of development are altered. And so what happens then is when they come in for treatment, we have to return to activities that respond to that aspect of the brain development for them to be able to get to higher levels of development. So if I have an adolescent that comes in who can look pretty sharp and amazing, cognitive skills, and I may try to rationalize and talk to this person logically, if they were traumatized early in life, I'm working in an entirely wrong area of the brain. And so what I need to do is go back to middle or lower brain functioning to help that person. Think about it as a house. For your brain to develop, it needs a good foundation. And if there's a good foundation, then you can build a good frame. If there's a good frame, then you can build the walls, and you can have the siding and the roof. But if there's a faulty foundation, you can have the nicest looking siding and walls in the world, but it's a house of cards, and it's going to come down, and that's why adolescents struggle. So what we have to do is go back and look at that foundation. And the coolest thing that I think Perry has found is that some of these core expressive arts, music, drumming, yoga, massage, things like that, impact lower functions of the brain and help develop, redevelop those neural pathways, because when you're young, depending on your life experiences, some neural pathways are expanded and some get small. So we need to go back to some of those areas and expand the neural pathways. So when you look at young kids, imagine if a kid is in their crib and they start to cry. Usually, some parent or caregiver comes along, picks them up, holds them, embraces them with multi-sensory wave of things like sight and sound and touch, and the kid learns themselves, this world's a safe place. And that attachment is formed, and we realize, you know, I can love people and they're going to love me back. But now think about some of the kids we work with. They're laying in that cradle, and they start to cry, and the person comes along and says, knock it off, and smacks them, and then leaves the room. Right, what does the kid learn? What does the kid internalize? The world's not a safe place. How about the kid who starts to cry? They either diaper change or they're hungry, and they cry wanting to get help, and nobody comes at all. I worked with kids, like one kid I had, for the first 5 years of his life, instead of hiring childcare, the parents just locked the kid up in a closet while they're at work. So what does the kid learn then? They cry for a while and then they stop crying. Why? Yeah, and so that kid learns that the world is not a safe place, and if I'm going to do anything, I've got to do it for myself. Now you may say, well, who cares? The issue is, that's the foundation of love. That's the foundation of intimacy. That's the foundation of further relationships. So when you have somebody who has relationship problems in high school or young adult or whatever else, some of that can be tracked sometimes back to those early experiences. So when we work with kids who are traumatized, we have to recognize that we're working with a different brain superhighway, that certain things have been developed, certain neural pathways, and others haven't. And what we have to do is use activities to stimulate the part of the brain to get those avenues opened up again so we can build a stronger foundation and a better frame.
You're saying those pathways can be opened up?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a really important point, right? Because one of the fears is that once they're shut down, are they permanently shut down? And Perry and a lot of others have found not at all. They can be re-stimulated and grow again. A couple other things I want to say in regards to expressive arts and spirituality. I found that expressive arts help kids' spiritual awareness and development, and it can, I think in many ways, it can help kids connect to self-understanding, self-meaning, relationships, connectedness, and connection with the divine. A person who has studied spirituality and child trauma a lot says the relationship between these two variables is much more complicated. Now, why is that? Because I know that a lot of you heard Mary yesterday talking about spirituality and trauma, and she talked about it a little bit, but not very much. This is a complex relationship, because for some kids, child trauma increases their pursuit of spiritual things, of search for meaning, search for the divine. And for other kids, it repels them against it. For some kids, their spiritual beliefs or their religious tradition is a stress reducer and is a protective factor as they heal from trauma. Other kids, it's the exact opposite. And the reason why I want to point this out is that it's not as easy just to say, you know, if you develop spiritual development with kids, it's going to help you heal from trauma. For some of the kids, it's a lot harder than that. And the reason why that is because of their conception. How many of you have studied Fowler stages of faith development? Pretty common. If you haven't, study them. They kind of follow Piaget stages and Kohlberg stages of development. But if you study Fowler stages of spiritual development, you realize that some of those early stages where kids are at, the kids think about God as a remote authority figure. God's up in the sky. If you have them draw pictures of what God looks like, God's usually anthropomorphized. Thank you. And so it takes on human features. So you see an old man with a great beard and that sort of thing. That's our view of God. And it's like outside of us. It's external to me, usually up in the sky. And it's also this person who is the judge and ruler. And if you're good, you're rewarded. If you're bad, you're punished. Now, this is complex because if that's their view of God, then it's easy to get that mixed up with other authority love figures in your life. So if your father was the perpetrator of sexual abuse, and this is somebody you loved, who had power over you, and somebody you also hated, then it's easy to transfer that to God or a higher authority. And so that's why this relationship gets really complex when you're talking about spirituality and trauma. I'm going to keep moving on here. Walker suggests incorporating stories, songs, or passages from sacred texts into treatment. And he says that if you study those stages of Fowler, that we can use things that are repetitious, that will impact lower areas of the brain, such as Sunday school songs, very simple child's Bible stories and that sort of thing, to help kids learn about God in a different way, about a loving God, a caring God, a God who doesn't have the intent to hurt us. And he says that can be very powerful in working with kids who have been traumatized. All right, for the second half of this hour, what I want to do is talk about two programs that are incredibly important to me. Okay? First one is Hesse House Home and Shelter, which is in Aurora, Illinois. And the second one is Casa Hogar Los Angelitos, which is in Manzanillo, Mexico. So the first one, Hesed House, the word Hesed comes from the Old Testament when it talks about steadfast love or loving kindness. And so Hesed House is the second largest homeless shelter in Illinois. It's located in Aurora, which is the second largest city in Illinois. It sleeps on average 220 people a night. Out of those 220 people a night that it sleeps in two huge buildings on both sides of the street, out of those 220, about 50 to 60 of them are children. And so there's a lot of kids living there at the homeless shelter. Their current operating budget is about $4.2 million, and they serve approximately 200 children per year. In the summer of 2007, I teach in the DSW program, MSW program, and BSW program. And in our MSW program, I was teaching a summer course, and it was on community leadership. And it was nice. I love teaching summer courses because the class size is really small and stuff like that. But I had a small class, really bright students. And so I said, you know, instead of sitting here all summer and talking about theory, why don't we go out in the community and do something, right? Why don't we put it into action? And so we started interviewing different agencies, what they could do if they had extra hands and extra feet that summer. Now, I had worked with Hesed House with my church for many years, serving, you know, the meals and stuff like that for those in the overnight shelter. So I knew about it, so that was one of the stops that we made. When we went there, the director of volunteering said, you know, Don, we've got 50, 60 kids here, and all of our limited resources go towards helping the parents, getting them mental health treatment, addictions treatment, job training, vocational training, all those types of things, education, GED, and I said, we have no resources for kids. Can you do something that would help us with the kids? So I let the class decide, and the class decided this is what we want to do. So then the class wrote up a business plan. They presented the business plan to the board of directors, and they developed a curriculum. And what we created was a group that we would do multiple times a week for a couple hours, where we go in and do therapeutic play and expressive arts therapy with the kids that were there. Okay? I misspoke. I didn't mean to say expressive arts therapy. Expressive art activities. Okay? We would do that with the kids there. So we started doing it during July of 2007. And so we did it for a couple months, and the program was wildly successful, meaning that kids reported better, doing better in summer school. Kids reported doing better with their families. Kids reported better problem solving, all those types of things. So it was pretty successful. And so when the summer ended and our class ended, we kind of had an exit strategy and we were ready to go. And the board of directors and the director of the agency said, "You can't leave." And said, "These kids have had way too much abandonment. You're doing something that actually works. You need to stay and do something." I said, "Well, I can't, you know, it's, when they were students, I could kind of require them to come, but I can't require them to come if it's not part of the class." So I sat down with the students and I said, "Any of you willing to keep going on with this with me?" And three of them said yes. And so those three students and I kept the program running that fall, and it's been running ever since. It's the longest volunteer-led program at that place. And so I want to tell you a little bit about that program. You can see this picture is with me with a group of little ones. Like I said, I'm not sure why God is having me do this, but little ones here, and you can tell who the biggest kid probably is in that picture. But here's some other quick pictures of the program. Let me tell you a little bit about what we did to get it started. Is they had no money. We had no money. So how do you do this program? And so after being in the field so many years, it's not just what you know, it's who you know. So I started asking people. And I started talking about it with people. I knew some people at the local paper, and so they did some articles about the program in the paper. And then a friend from mine from high school saw the article, and she said, "You know, I can get my church behind this." And so she got her church behind this, and in another 2 weeks, we had $5,000 worth of art supplies. And then another friend of mine saw what we're doing. She said, "I'm a regional director of Girl Scouts. I get a bunch of Girl Scout troops on this." So they got more art supplies and more games and that kind of stuff. And so we had a ton of stuff then in that regard. So then volunteers. So then we had to go to the local colleges and say, do you have any early childhood specialists? Do you have any psychologists? Do you have any social workers? Are you willing to come in? The hardest part of that was trying to get a long-term commitment, right? Because most people want to volunteer for one shot or a week or something like that. Well, these kids, you know, remember that comfort and safety comes from consistency and predictability. So you need somebody that they're going to see week after week after week. So we tried to get a 3-month commitment out of each of the volunteers, and we have to run a background check and do all those other types of things on them. So that was our next task, get all these volunteers. And so then we had to get a space. So we found a couple of rooms, small rooms, in this old building. And we just put some tables in there. We bought some like folding tables, card tables, as you can see here. And then we started putting these things out into like activity areas. So there'd be like clay and Play-Doh in one area, there'd be sand tray in another area, there'd be puppets in this area, and we put those out, and we allowed kids to come in, and there was a volunteer in each one of the areas, and we let them free play. Again, we're not analyzing, we're not assessing, we're not saying, well, this clinically means that, you know, this and that. We're doing that. We're using the inherent value of them expressing themselves in that setting. So this is Erica in the green here. She was one of the co-founders with me. And after she did the program for a long time, they actually hired her at Hesed House as a staff after she graduated. And then the school district wanted to, because she did such a nice job advocating for the kids in the school, that they hired her in the school district to be the liaison for kids who were homeless. And so now she works for District 129 and does that, but she's still not the director of the program. And she's done an amazing job for many, many years. This other person, Sharon, you can see all the different types of activities that we're doing here. One of the neat things that happened is, you don't see it in this picture, but the space that we have, we applied for a grant called the Bright Spaces Grant. And this is where they get like $10,000, and they come in, a corporation comes in, and they totally redo the room. So they came in and repainted everything. They put new cabinets. They put a flat screen TV. They put up computers. They did all that stuff as part of the Bright Spaces Grant for us. That was just a couple of years ago. This is the sand table that we got built for us. One of the volunteers' husband was a construction worker. She said, "I bet I can get him to build us a sand table." And so we had a sand table, and the kids had a great time with that. One of the things that was really important was to find volunteers who were skilled but also looked like the clients they were serving. So they couldn't all be white Caucasian folks, right? Because we serve a lot of African American and Latino clients. And so one of the things we try to do is recruit a diverse group of volunteers. Another kind of phenomenon that happened is that we started the program for the little ones, then all of a sudden the elementary school kids and the junior high kids started showing up and saying, what about us? And so they would try to sneak in. You can see these older kids hanging out here with one of our school social workers there, hanging out saying, why can't I play with them, right? And so they started to get involved, and what we ended up doing is breaking off a separate group for junior high kids. Then, of course, the high school kids came. So we broke off another group for those. And so we had 3 to 4 groups running, different ages, because when we tried to mix this group with that group, it wasn't so successful. And we learned a lot of things, like I said, out of desperation. And so as we learned and evolved, we learned some lessons. And so we run multiple groups, but then we had space issues and all those other types of things that you do as you grow. Another cool thing that happened is when you're working with little kids, you always want to make sure that you have volunteers with other volunteers, right? Because these kids have been traumatized and you worry about them getting re-traumatized. So we've always had that. And another thing we had is we had a big glass window on the outside of the room so people walking by could see in, right? Now, when the parents drop off their kids, they have 2 hours of rest. They can go shopping, they can just go rest, they can watch TV. What we noticed was the moms were lining up at the window, watching what we were doing with the kids. And they were going, afterwards, when they picked up their kids, they're like, how could you get them to sit for an hour? How could you get them to cooperate with each other? They're all fighting with me. How could you? And we realized that another component of this program had to be the parents, that we had to incorporate the parents. And so now we do family events, and we do cooperative expressive arts with moms and kids and dads sitting together and doing these different activities to start the same kind of dialogue. Because what we realized is a lot of these parents had a similar childhood to the kids. And remember that brain development? We want to talk to these parents and use logic and cognitive behavioral therapy and dialectical and all this. And we got to go back earlier. And these parents were playing with Play-Doh as much as the little kids were and loved it, had a good time with it. And so you want to make it enjoyable and engaging because you want them to come back. But you also want it to serve a therapeutic purpose. The second program I want to tell you about is in Manzanillo, Mexico. How did I get there? When my dad retired after my mom died, he sold his house where in the town I grew up, which is close to Aurora, and he bought a small condo in that town, and then he also looked for someplace warm for the winters. And so he ended up looking at a place in Mexico and buying a condo that's right on the ocean in Mexico. It's gorgeous. So for the last 20 years, my family, my wife and 2 kids, have had a wonderful place to go and to enjoy, you know, vacationing down there right on the ocean and everything else. During my trips, I'm a social worker, so I got to go out and look at social programs, right? So over the last 20 years, I've been checking out all the different social programs that are down there. And so they have 3 orphanages in Manzanillo. 2 are by the Catholic Church, done so the Catholic orphanages, and one's sponsored by a place called the Children's Foundation, which is out of Loveland, Colorado. And so that program, when I visited it, had a lot more kids coming down for mission trips, people coming down from churches in the United States and stuff like that. So there was the kids were more fluent in English. The staff was more fluent in English, and I know just enough Spanish to be dangerous. And so I needed to find some place with I thought that I could connect with where language wouldn't be such a huge barrier. So I started to connect with that place, and I when I was able to then get a sabbatical, I asked the provost where I'm at. I said, you know, what I'd really like to do is learn more about how to use expressive art with kids who are traumatized at a faith-based organization because I'm really interested in the spirituality piece. He says, you got a place to do it? I said, yeah, it's in Mexico. And so I said, I'm going to propose to take my semester sabbatical there. And then I had to convince my wife, because I had 2 teenagers, right, the last year to say, can I be gone for 3-4 months at a time? And she says, as long as we come visit a lot, then it's okay. And so I went down there and had an opportunity to interact with Nancy, who's the director of the program. And part of it for me is, what's the win-win situation for us if I go down there? And so for Nancy, she inherently used expressive arts in this program, and I was so impressed by it. The win for me was I want to learn more about what you do and how you do it. For her, she says, I have an academic who's an academic writer and a teacher, and most of my staff either has a high school degree or my clinicians have a bachelor's degree. Can you train us on things like neuroscience and child trauma and stuff like that? And I said, that sounds like a win-win. So my job when I was down there was I trained all three levels of staff. I trained the child care workers, which they call house mamas, right? And I trained the clinical staff, psychologists and social workers, mostly with a bachelor's degree. And then I also trained the administrators, because my PhD is in nonprofit management. And so I trained the administrators in how to run things more efficiently and effective and how to get grants and all that kind of stuff. And it was a really positive experience. And then I got a great opportunity to work with the toughest cases. Because the thing about, the thing about Casa Hogar Los Angelitos is because it's partly funded from a foundation in the United States, it has higher revenues to work with than those Catholic orphanages down there. And because of that, they send all of the worst and most complex cases, abuse cases, to Casa Hogar Los Angelitos. And so I had to consult on cases where kids were chained to walls, where kids were prostitutes at age 5. Just some of the most horrific cases you can ever imagine were in the orphanage there. And the work that they do was incredible. It was amazing, and I was glad too that I was able to do anything for them. The other thing I did as a sabbatical down there is in the 20 years I've been going down there, is I also realized that one of the biggest schools of social work in the area was about an hour away, and that's at the University of Colima. So while I was down there, I also connected with them, kind of compared pedagogies, how do you do what you do, how do you teach social work here, what does that look like, and so we did some comparing notes, and I spoke with faculty and students there. So this is Casa Hogar Los Angelitos. If you look at it now, it takes up an entire city block in Manzanillo. You can see in this picture like that big white wall that literally goes around a whole city block. And a lot of it came through private donations. A lot of it came from the Rotary clubs, various Rotary clubs and stuff like that. And a lot of it came from Nancy, the person who founded it on her own money to develop the program. But it didn't start that way. It started out as a soup kitchen. This is Nancy Nystrom. She just wrote a great autobiography about her experience and how she started this. She lost her son when he was in his 20s, back in the 90s. And she was trying to grieve his loss and recoup and kind of try to get her head back on straight. And she decided to go down with some friends to Manzanillo. And she was struck by how many street kids there were. And one time she had this, she said that this voice that she believed to be God said, you need to do something about these kids. You know, this is a good way to grieve the loss of your son, a good way to help. And so she made a commitment to do that. So she got a place down there, and she developed a soup kitchen for these kids. And the soup kitchen, the street kids came, and there was hundreds of them. And then later there was a couple hundreds of them. And finally she said, I'm feeding all of them, but then I'm sending them back out into the mean streets, you know, back to prostitution, back to crime, back to all those things in the evening. I've got to do something about that. And so that's when she decided to actually build the orphanage. And so she now has two big pieces of property, and one of them houses the little kids, and another one the adolescent girls, and the other property houses adolescent boys. As you can imagine, as social workers, you understand that, right? When I started in residential care as an administrator, we did adolescent residential programs together. And I learned very quickly we needed to separate them at that point in time. They were sneaking through ceiling tiles and everything else to get to one another, and so it's quite a distraction. And she had a separate piece of property for the adolescent boys and a separate piece of property for the adolescent girls. And neat thing is that some of the kids have been there long enough now where they're starting college. None of these kids would ever dream about going to college. So she just built this new kind of independent living facility for the kids who are in college. It's like their own apartment, but they can have access to the food and medical care and everything else that she provides down there. It's a pretty neat program. The kids are anywhere from, they come right at birth all the way through college, so the age range is pretty remarkable. She has anywhere between 70 to, I think, close to 90 to 100 kids down there now. And these kids come from all over the place. She also does an outreach with people who come north from Central America into Mexico to work the fields. Those kids are out with no education at all. And so she goes out into the field. I've been with her many times. We're going to these camps, and they're living with sticks and garbage bags, kind of a tent. No plumbing, no water, no anything. And so she offers to bring them into the orphanage to educate them and to give them training and stuff like that. The problem is the parents need them out in the field. And so it's a constant struggle negotiating with the parents about, you know, they need, because they make equivalently of our $30 a week if the whole family goes out there and works for the entire week. They make about $30. And if the kids aren't involved in that, it impacts their financial situation. So Nancy, before she went to Mexico, worked in an art gallery, and she's always been kind of an artsy-fartsy kind of person, a person who enjoys expressive arts. And so when she went down there, she has no clinical training at all. And she realized very quickly, again, kind of the same way I did, instinctually, that with kids and with adolescents recovering from trauma, there's got to be a better way than traditional talk therapy to work with them. And so she started introducing the arts to them. And so she got volunteers from the United States to come down, volunteers from Manzanillo to come in and teach piano lessons, guitar lessons, violin lessons. And then she got people to donate the instrument. When I was down there, I'm part of a men's group at my church, my Lutheran church, and I called up and I said, you know what? They've had three damaged guitars. Can you guys pull together and send me some money so that I can go out and get these guys a bunch more guitars when I'm down here? And the guys in my men's group Bible study pulled together, they got the money, and was able to buy them a bunch of new guitars. And that's how Nancy built the program. So then she got the art supplies donated, similar to the way I did things at Hesed House, and she's really developed this pretty amazing program there. The coolest thing that she's done, I think, well, she's done a lot of cool things, one of the coolest things is that she developed this dance group. She got this guy who was a dance instructor from the University of Colima, one of the best dance instructors around, and he came in and he trained a group of junior high and high school kids how to do traditional Mexican dance from all the different regions of Mexico. And they got so good in the last few years that they started traveling around and doing performances in Manzanillo. Then they started traveling around doing performances throughout Mexico. The last few years they've come and done a tour in the United States, and now they're going to Canada. That's how good they've become. And the really neat thing is that it's become so prestigious and such a status thing for the kids in the orphanage. Now all the little ones say, when can I do it? When can I do it? So they've got like these junior dance clubs for these little kids who want to become, and they don't say hello or goodbye up there without doing a dance and a song for you. And so when I come, when I go, they did a whole big dance, and the little kids were doing their traditional dance and stuff, and it's very cool. And the thing about it is, it is neat and it's cool, but when you think about it from a clinical standpoint, I was sitting one time listening to them practice, and on the shoes of each one of them is taps. So every dance has a rhythm to it. And I can close my eyes, and I can hear the rhythm. And the little kids, you can see them when they're watching, they're tapping the rhythm out on their knees, because that's how they're learning. Now what is that doing as far as developing neural pathways in the brain? Repetition, same pattern, triggering those lower brain functions. So drumming circles, those dances with caps and stuff are all ways and to develop those neural pathways to help those kids get the infrastructure so they can handle the emotions and the pain and the cognitions of what happened to them and thrive. So another thing about the use of expressive arts is that it's incredibly, I think, inexpensive way. And I think this is important because when you work in third world countries, when you work in programs like Hesed House, it's a homeless shelter, there's very little money. You can't hire a bunch of music therapists, art therapists, drama therapists. You'd love to, but you can't. And in some countries, they don't even exist, right? You have to ship them down. And so how can you use expressive arts in a therapeutic way and not go beyond the scopes of your competencies? Use them in a therapeutic way, but not do something that's unethical or do something that's inappropriate. And so I think that it's an incredibly cost-efficient method. And so by getting just a handful of donations, getting some people to come in and volunteer how to teach, I think it's incredibly therapeutic. tool for a pretty low investment. And so I found it to be really cost effective, right? The other thing that I found down there was because all the kids participate in those expressive art activities together, whether it's music lessons, dance, painting, all that stuff, they're supporting one another, learning from one another, teaching one another, they're talking to one another about things that they wouldn't normally talk about. And they realize very quickly that I'm not in this alone. There's a bond that occurs, and it breaks their sense of shame and isolation. They discover symbols, labels, and other forms of expression that accurately reflect the inner landscapes of their own heart. So I think that when I see the older kids mentoring the younger kids, when I see kids saying that, you know, that is the coolest thing I ever heard, what a great, you know, concept, what a great picture, I think it's really powerful to see how the older kids help out the younger ones. This is a music group up here, as you can see the drums that they do drumming circles with. This is an activity that they did where they took all the broken bottles that they found, and they smashed them up into little pieces, and they put them into a big thing of sand, and they run the broken glass in the sand enough and stir it around enough where it removes the tough edges, the sharp edges, and then it makes little mosaics, and they create sculptures out of those pieces of glass. And so they created, they have a fundraiser down there that's in December. And the reason why they have it in December is that's when all the rich Americans come down and stay by the ocean like my father. And he's not rich, but kind of wish. They come down and they have this auction or this thing where they put these out and they sell them and then put more money back into. So it's self-sustaining, meaning that it's paying for new supplies and all that kind of stuff as it goes. We talked about how the pattern and repetitive neural inputs alter the lower stress response areas of the brain. As children, Casso, Garland, Samuelitos, connected with their poems, songs, dances, or paintings, they become more aware of their thoughts, emotions, and core beliefs. This assists them in self-discovery and self-understanding and helps them find meaning and hard to understand experiences. I also feel like it helps them with their spiritual development. At Casa Agarro Los Angelitos, they don't push their faith, just like Casa does, they don't push it down their throat. Like some homeless shelters or orphanages, you know, there's a sermon in the soup. You know, to get the benefits, you're going to be force-fed the faith tradition. And they don't do that here. And I think because they don't do that here, the kids are more responsive to it. And the kids come by invitation. And I was surprised, even though it's totally voluntary, how many kids participate in spiritual services. It's a Christian organization, and they respect all faiths of the kids, but most of them come to the Christian faith worship services that they have. And in that, I think the reason why it's successful is because they had a volunteer youth leader come from the community who understands the program, and it's all done through the arts. So it's all done in song, it's all done in dance, it's all done through video presentations and stuff like that. It's all multimedia. It's incredibly engaging. It's incredibly interactive. It's not like my faith, the Lutherans, were frozen chosen, right? So you sit quietly and you tell us what to believe. This is much more interactive and connected with the kids, and they really relate to that. It engages them into the process of, what is my worldview? What do I believe? How do I find meaning? And so one of the things why I did when I was down there is that there was a shortage of Bibles. And so I called my in-laws who have this connection, and my wife came down on one of her trips. They just stuffed bags and bags and bags with paperback Spanish Bibles. And so we were able to give every single kid that came their own personal Bible. And that was such a meaningful thing that they could read that at night and they could connect to that, again, in a way that they wanted to, not in a way that was being forced on them. You have to be very cautious because, like I said, that idea that the authority figure is going to be forceful, punitive, pushed down your throat kind of thing is what steers them away from their spiritual development. And what we want to do is engage them and connect them to that, a loving and caring God. So final thoughts, almost out of time here. So given the limited access to psychological resources at Hess House and Casa Agarro Los Angelitos, Expressive arts are a relatively inexpensive and effective method to engage children who experience trauma. The next thing is I would say that there is a natural restoration, rejuvenation, and healing that occurs when we dance, sing, paint, write, and draw. The creative process works as a catalyst in the children's emotional, social, physical, and spiritual growth. What I think the next step is I want to hook with the art therapist, music therapist, exercise physiologist, drama therapist, and I want him to go into these programs and teach counselors, teach house mamas, teach them how to do those activities at a safe level where they're not going to get in over their heads, where they can get the most benefit, natural healing, therapeutic benefit from those activities without stepping over their bounds of competencies and saying, yes, now I'm going to use it as an assessment tool or a clinical approach or this or that. And so I think that if we could do that, I mean, like I said, it would be great if I could just find a bunch we could hire and bring them into the orphanage in Mexico. Number one, a lot of Mexican cities don't have those specialists there. And number two, a lot of them can't travel down there. So how can we bring the training of that to them? I can do that somewhat because of some experience, but I would really love for them to do that. If we're looking at the homeless shelter, we do have those professionals around who can help. I think if we do that, it does two things. One is it tells the people who got a master's degree and certification in those areas, we're not stepping on your toes here. I have no intention of saying what we're doing is music therapy or drama therapy or art therapy. And what I want to do is I want to show you what we're doing so you know the difference and you can spell that out. The second thing is it says to the organization that this is a valued thing that maybe we should invest in a real art therapist and a real music therapist and take this to the next level, right? Because this is the first level. How do we bring it to the next level? The more technology advances, the more we learn about brain science, the more we learn about neural pathways and neurological development, the more we're learning the value of expressive arts and helping kids heal from trauma and increase a healthy spiritual well-being. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today for NACSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to thoughtfully integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NACSW's activities and events, including NACSW's upcoming convention in the fall, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NACSW members, and which includes free CEUs accredited by the Association of Social Work Boards, our online continuing education program, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the member section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NACSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NACSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening in today to our podcast session today.